Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Three segments up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Danielle Allen, who investigated the source of one of those Obama is a Muslim emails and has some thoughts on how the Internet is affecting political discourse, not all of it to the good. Then we'll hear from Patrick McCulley, Executive Director of International Rivers, who'll talk about the scam of carbon offsets and other climate change issues. And finally, we'll hear from the sociologist Vicki Smith, co-author of The Good Temp, a book about how contingent employment seems to be the new model. Today's show is pretty jam-packed, so I'll keep the opening economic commentary short. The economic scene continues to be dominated by the twin torments of recession and inflation, though the recession is mostly in the U.S., while inflation is everywhere. Oil prices continue to push higher, the core of the inflation problem. Those price pressures prompted the European Central Bank to raise interest rates by a quarter of a point on Thursday. But European economies, which had been holding up pretty well against the credit crisis that originated in the U.S. last summer, now look to be slowing down, which may be just what the European central bankers want. They're an austere lot. And Asian stock markets have been very weak, suggesting that maybe an economic slowdown's in their future as well. A global slowdown would really take the pressure off oil prices, and since some impossible to determine but nonetheless significant portion of the rise has been the result of speculators, it wouldn't be a shock to see oil prices head south in a hurry sometime in the next few months. I'm sure John McCain would like that. Thursday morning brought the release of the U.S. employment report for June. It normally comes out on the first Friday of the month, but they pushed it ahead for the July 4th holiday. June continues the trend that's been in place all year, slow but steady job losses. This time the headline number was -62,000, but that got an assist from surprising and probably temporary strength in government employment, which rose by almost 30,000. Private sector employment was off by 91,000. The unemployment rate held steady at 5.5%, which was actually bad news, since last month saw a sharp rise that some analysts thought was a statistical quirk, but evidently it wasn't. Also, the report offered signs that people are withdrawing from the job market out of despair over finding work. The job market is far from collapsing. In a normal recession, we'd be seeing declines five times what we've been seeing lately. But we've now seen six straight months of negative numbers, something never seen outside recessions. As I've said before, since job growth was quite weak during the expansion, which ran from 2002 through the end of last year, it's likely that job losses won't be as severe as they've been in past downturns. But average incomes barely rose for most people in the expansion, and now they're declining, so the 2000s so far have been fairly terrible for the American working class, and things are only going to get worse in the coming months. Okay, let's take a musical break. I read a profile of the Feelies, who are opening for Sonic Youth in Battery Park on Friday evening, in the paper the other day. That took me back to the 1980s, the waning days of my very extended post-adolescence. So let's listen to some Feelies. That was some of the Feelies' song It's Only Life from 20 years ago. My first guest today is Danielle Allen. Allen, who holds the UPS Foundation Chair at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, is quite the polymath, a classicist first and now a political theorist as well. A while back, she got an email revealing that Barack Obama is really a Muslim, which he isn't, of course, but the rumor persists. Allen decided to investigate the origins of the email. I won't say smear, since there's nothing disreputable about being a Muslim, even though some people may think so. Her investigation is interesting enough, but what she has to say about the influence of the Internet on political discourse is even more interesting. Danielle Allen. Thanks for joining us. Danielle Allen, you got a spam email. Instead of hitting the delete key, you decided to investigate it. The report that Barack Obama was a secret Muslim was just too much to take, right?
Well, it was a surprising email to me. Also, it came from a friend who is a person I think very well of, and he was buying it. That surprised me. So that meant to me that I had to take it more seriously.
So how'd you go about your research?
Well, I was already working generally on the question of the impact of the internet on politics. So I had already, for example, been familiarizing myself with the smears against McCain in 2000 and Kerry in 2004. So I had a general sense of a context in which one should expect chain emails to be generated in a grassroots fashion. So I wasn't really looking for an organization behind these. So I wanted to try to figure out what the networks of people were who might be motivating this conversation. My first effort was to look at the names that were on the list of addresses in the chain email. That didn't get me very far. So then I began searching unusual phrases through Google, and that was better, and I ran into some good luck. I more or less ran into some posts from the summer of 2007 that referred me back to Free Republic in January of 2007. And lo and behold, when I started working my way through the archives of Free Republic, there was a very clear picture of a conversation about Obama and his politics and his religion that was sort of loosey-goosey up through the middle of December 2006 and then coalesced really fast around the specific text of the email that we've all come to know as the smear email.
I'm surprised to hear people were paying that close attention to him back in 2006.
Oh, it goes farther back than that. I mean, from the moment that he ran for Senate in Illinois, there has been fairly constant conversation on the Free Republic website about him as a candidate. So there has been commentary on his voting record, commentary on this false idea that he's a Muslim, and so forth from that point.
So who did you track it down to?
Well, at the end of the day, I don't think we can say we tracked it down to a specific person, but what we tracked it down to first of all, there are a group of people who have written articles that purport to represent Obama's biography but do so falsely. They tend to publish these articles in online organs, typically organs that are their own. So in other words, these are not vetted publications. I think of these as self-publications or vanity press publications. And then after they publish these, they themselves or somebody else typically posts them into Free Republic. And then there are a group of bloggers who have been working on generating things to say about Obama for some time. And so that group of bloggers is pretty wide-ranging. One blogger in particular named Cedar seems to have posted the original text of the email on January 8th, 2007, and then reposted it again January 15th and January 16th, and the final time saying, "Circulate, please, to families and friends." And that stretch of time seems to be the stretch of time in which the email goes from being a small blip on the radar screen to sort of taking on its viral proportions.
How long a time are you talking about? Just weeks?
Yes. So the first instance of the email that anybody's found is December 29th, 2006. It was acquired by Snopes at that point. The version that Snopes had on that day is an excerpted version, actually, of the text that appears on January 8th. So Cedar, on January 8th, appears to have posted the full text of the original version of the email. And then by January 17th, it's many places. It's been posted multiple times in Free Republic, but it's also now being posted outside of Free Republic, and it's starting to move.
It seems that these sorts of things are hitting fairly well-prepared ground. People want to believe this about him, don't they?
It does seem that way. I think here it's also important to look at the whole history of smears. So we have really been living through the development of new techniques for impacting politics, and we saw them sort of in full force first against McCain in 2000 and then Kerry in 2004. There's one fellow who's pretty interesting, Ted Sampley, who's been involved in all the smears along the way, and he's really the person who has been hitting hard the drum of the idea that there might be a Manchurian candidate out there. So he referred to McCain in 2000 as a Manchurian candidate. He referred to Kerry in 2004 as a Manchurian candidate and Obama. So one of the ironies of the current election is that both McCain and Obama have been smeared by the same people.
Smears have been around forever in politics, American and otherwise, but is there something about the Internet that has changed the nature of the smear besides the speed with which it can spread?
The speed with which it can spread is critical, and also the difficulty of tracing the originating source. But I think there's another, there are two other things that are important about it. One is that people need to recognize essentially that what's developed is a competitive culture of storytelling. Who can tell the story the best? So you get many different versions and individual bloggers really taking ownership of the story. So it's a mistake to think for this sort of internet smear, so it's different from television ads or people who are still doing push polling on telephones and so forth. For the internet smears, it really does seem that what you've got is a lot of do-it-yourself citizen activists who have found good launching pads for their activism and then are competing with each other to see who can generate the best story, the most effective story, the funniest image, the most sort of plausible but inaccurate story and so forth. I think of this in some sense as like traditional cultures of folklore or myth-making or even of oral poetry. So I'm a classicist originally. The Iliad is a poem of which for which we say there's no known author. We call the author Homer, but Homer is sort of a tag for describing a process whereby there was a set of stories, a set of myths, and poets started competing over who could tell the best version. And finally somebody told the best version and it got written down, and that's what we call the Iliad now. But so you say, see the same sort of mobility on the internet. That makes it a lot harder to pin things down than if you are dealing with print media or even television and so forth. The second thing that I consider incredibly important is the national scope of these emails. So I've made a comment about this before, but the James Madison, when he wrote Federalist 10, was very concerned with the question of faction. Democracies will have factions, in his view, because faction is, it feeds on liberty, and democracy depends on liberty. There's nothing you can do to get rid of the causes of faction. But democracies do need to be mindful of their effects and do what they can to control them. Madison thought that geography and a very fragmented political system federally constructed would be an adequate check on factions. But that really is gone thanks to the internet. So I think we have to give a little thought to how else we might try to reduce the effects of faction.
Finally, there's been a lot of talk about what the internet has done to our politics. It's certainly done something, but what's your evaluation of the mix of signal and noise? Which predominates?
I'm not sure I fully understand your what you mean by relationship between signal and noise.
Is truth and untruth, information and disinformation. What's the ratio?
There's a heck of a lot of disinformation floating around. For me, the bigger thing, though, is the question of whether or not people are in a position to spot it and sort their way through it. And that's where, for me, the culture of anonymity on the web is a real problem. So, obviously, there's been anonymous political writing throughout time, and, of course, the Federalist Papers themselves were anonymous texts originally. I think it's important, though, to make a distinction between writing that expresses principles. So the Federalist Papers is a text that articulates general ideas about how politics works. You won't find any ad hominem in it or any attacks on particular individuals, character attacks, and so forth. In contrast, on the web, what we've got is a widespread culture of attacking left and right all over the place anonymously. And so this is really the difference between accusations where somebody takes responsibility, stands up, puts their name forward in public, offers evidence and is ready to argue about it, and slander, on the other hand, which is secret and cowardly and done in the dark and so forth. It seems to me that one needs a culture of accusation where accusers take responsibility for what they're saying in order to have a culture of argument. And in my view, one needs a culture of argument in order to sort out the truth from the false. So I've talked to a bunch of people who will say things like, well, but the truth will just win out. You know, don't be so worried about all the stuff on the internet. The logical structure of an argument will stand for itself. I don't think that's actually true. I think, instead, processes of dialectic back and forth are critical to sorting out true from false, and you can't do that if the folks who are putting the arguments out there won't identify themselves.
Seems like we have a culture of competitive monologues now.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly the right way to put it. Exactly.
That was Danielle Allen, a classicist and political theorist who is a scholar at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. And now a quick change of gears to talk about good and bad ways to address climate change with Patrick McCulley, Executive Director of International Rivers, based in Berkeley. Unfortunately, McCulley was in Spain when we recorded the interview, and the transatlantic phone connection was not the best. In this interview, Patrick McCulley and I talk about cap-and-trade schemes, and I'm not sure that we defined that well enough. Though there are many versions of cap-and-trade, as Patrick will say, the fundamental principle is that a government sets a limit, the cap, on greenhouse gas emissions for entities like utilities, factories, and refineries. The cap declines over time. If the emitter can get its emissions below the cap level, then it can sell the right to emit to entities who can't get them below. That's the trade part. It appeals to free market types because they love trading. Many economists, and this is one of those rare instances where I'll side with the economist, find these awkward and complex and prefer the simpler approach of taxing the carbon content of fuels at a rate that rises over time to discourage their use. Okay, enough definitions. Patrick McCulley. Welcome to Behind the News, Patrick McCulley. So did you buy any offsets for your flight from California to Europe?
No, I didn't. I'm not a great fan of offsets.
Offsets are an important part of the Kyoto Protocol's Clean Development Mechanism. Tell us about the CDM.
Well, the Clean Development Mechanism is the world's biggest offset market. It's probably about 95% of all offsets in the world come through the CDM, and it's part of the Kyoto Protocol, and it's turned out to be a very important part of the Kyoto Protocol. And, in fact, the countries, mainly the Europeans and the Japanese, that have ratified the protocol and are making serious efforts to try and meet their obligations are actually making these efforts not by actually cutting their emissions, but by buying these carbon offsets. And this is a big problem because very many of these carbon offsets do not actually represent cuts in emissions as they're supposed to. So the cuts in emissions supposed to happen under the Kyoto Protocol, which already were very minor, are not even being seen.
Who came up with this scheme?
Well, somewhat ironically, it was the U.S. that they really pushed the whole CDM idea through at the Kyoto negotiations. And ironic because Al Gore was actually head of the U.S. delegation at the time, so it's in some way he's responsible for it. It was based really on the idea of the emissions trading in the U.S. that happened under the Clean Air Act for acid rain, for nitrous oxide. Problem is that dealing with acid rain and rather sulfur dioxide in the U.S. was relatively simple. Dealing with carbon dioxide on a worldwide basis and dealing not with emissions, which you would have dealt with in the U.S. emissions trading program, but emissions reductions, which are a much more intangible and difficult to measure quantity. And it's turned out that it just has not worked. But while there are many technical problems with the working of it, the lots of money, billions of dollars, about $13 billion last year, are changing hands. And the whole integrity of the Kyoto Protocol system is being seriously threatened.
Of course, in the U.S., where we can't even ratify the Kyoto Protocol, Kyoto might look pretty good, but it may shock some people to learn that it's got some serious problems.
Yeah.
All right, there are two things here that often get blended together. Emissions trading, cap-and-trade schemes, and offsets. They are not exactly the same, so let's start by talking about offsets. What are they?
Yeah, it's really complicated, and it's very hard for people to understand emissions tradings and the different types of emission trading, and which is really a problem because then it becomes very difficult for people to judge the viability of different suggestions coming from politicians. But basically, there's two main types of emissions trading. There is a cap-and-trade system, which we hear about a lot in the U.S. now, and it's already up and running in Europe, and that means you cap emissions, and then hopefully over time you bring down the number of allowances to emit that you give out, and so the amount of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases emitted has to be reduced over time. Now, the other type of trading system, which is often blended with cap and trade but is distinct, is this offset system, or what can be called baseline and offsets, or baseline and credit. And what that means is that you don't have any total cap, but for example, under the CDM, a investor in, say, Spain, where I'm talking from, and where they're buying a lot of these credits, but instead of, or rather a utility in Spain, instead of cutting their own emissions by reducing the amount of coal they burn here, say, they will give money to a project in China, for example, which may not be an energy project. Many of the Chinese projects are actually chemical company projects, and will pay them to fit some pollution control equipment which reduces their emissions. Now, the problem is that many of these projects are economically attractive projects, which probably would have happened anyway. So what's really happening is that, for example, Chinese chemical companies are getting billions, many billions of dollars to fit pollution control equipment, which probably they would have been forced to fit in any case. And they're being paid way over the odds, many, many times the cost of actually polluting this, of actually installing this equipment. And the way these two systems merge is that you have, in Europe, where you have this cap-and-trade system, but you're allowed to make your emission reductions not by actually reducing your emissions, which would seem the logical thing, but by buying these offset credits and then turning those credits in and saying, okay, I didn't reduce my own emissions, but I bought my emission reduction from somewhere else. And this system is now likely to come into the U.S., especially worrying John McCain's proposal, because he says actually there would be unlimited use of offsets under his carbon plan. And what that means is that there wouldn't actually need in the short term to be any emission cuts in the U.S. under McCain's plan. We would just buy all these supposed emission reductions from overseas.
Since you're staying in a nunnery now, I suppose it's appropriate to bring up the metaphor that sometimes people use, which is that offsets are like indulgences. You sin and then buy an indulgence to offset your sin. Are there any of these offset schemes that are worthwhile, or is it all a crock?
Well, it's complicated. There's two main types of offsets markets. There's the regulated market, which is the CDM, which is happening under the Kyoto Protocol, where countries actually have legal obligations to reduce their emissions, and these offsets they're buying have a legal character inside the Kyoto Protocol. That's by far the biggest market in terms of the dollar value. Now, there's also the voluntary market, which is the sort of thing you see in the U.S., where if you're going to take a flight, you say, well, you know, I feel guilty about doing this, so I'll buy some offsets from wind power, from reducing the methane from pig manure, say. And that's totally a voluntary decision. Now, in some ways, the voluntary market is much less regulated, so there's been a lot of concern about cowboy operators setting up and selling these emissions, which don't represent emission reductions, which actually don't represent anything. They're from phantom projects, or even selling the same emission reductions 7 or 8 times over. And without regulation, there's a lot of scope for abuse. But in some ways, I think the voluntary market is better, because maybe some reduction is happening in the voluntary market, and if you didn't buy the offset, no reductions would happen, so there may be some benefit. Under the regulated market, there is a legal obligation to reduce your emissions. So if there were no offsets in the regulated market, emissions would be reduced. But you introduce offsets, which maybe they represent an emission reduction, in many cases they clearly don't, then you're actually reducing the amount of emission reductions that are achieved. So it's probably better that people just decide, well, I'm going to drive from San Francisco to L.A. in any case, so I might as well buy an offset, and, you know, hopefully I'll get value for my money, and this actually will result in a wind turbine getting built somewhere. If it doesn't, well, you wasted a bit of money, but the climate hasn't suffered any.
The jargon, a lot of this is additionality, right? That
we're
actually something that's going to be done anyway is going to count as
additionality, as
your indulgence.
The key thing, and it's turning out to be extremely hard to measure, because what you have to measure is, did a developer intend to build a project or not, or did a developer intend to build the project without getting the carbon credits or the offsets, or is it only because they're getting these credits, the income from these credits, that they're building the project? It's turned out to be incredibly difficult to tell that, because, of course, developers of wind or hydropower or big manure projects or these industrial gas projects, of course they're very happy to get extra income, so of course they will claim that the only reason they're doing the project is because they are going to get the carbon credit income, and then they get the income, and that's nice, they have extra money, and if they get turned down, don't get the income, well, you know, they lost chance for a bit of extra money, but no harm, they go and do the project anyway. So there's this belief that it's quite straightforward measuring additionality. You look into the innards of the thing, and it's very difficult to measure.
With high energy prices and the climate and on everyone's mind now, some people are looking to hydro as a kind of clean approach to generating large amounts of energy. You are, of course, a longstanding critic of hydro. What's the problem with dams?
numerous problems with dams. I'm here in Spain at this international expo where we're mounting an exhibit of photographs from people displaced by dams around the world, and there are massive human rights abuses that have occurred associated with dams. 40 to 80 million people that have been displaced by their homes very rarely have been properly compensated, often have suffered greatly as a consequence, both sort of economically and in terms of their culture, the psychological impacts of being forced out of their homes, human rights impacts in terms of people being murdered because they are massacred, because they resist displacement, huge impacts on rivers. We're destroying our rivers around the world. Dams totally change the very character of a river. They change the flow patterns, they change the temperature, they change the chemistry, they change the physical nature of the river. It then has all these cascading impacts downstream. It wipes out fisheries, which of course is a huge problem now in the western U.S., very well known with the collapse of the salmon fishery. But in other parts of the world, there's actually many more species of migratory fish and much more serious impacts on fisheries and on the livelihoods of tens of millions of people who depend on inland fisheries for their main foods. Other impacts are often less understood, or for example, when you trap all the sediments in the reservoirs, two main impacts. One is that it makes hydropower a non-renewable resource, because when you have big reservoirs, those fill up with sediments and eventually the dam becomes useless, or almost so. Secondly, it robs downstream areas of sediments, which are important in stopping erosion. So you have, for example, down in the Gulf Coast of the U.S., you have the very rapid loss of wetlands, and so a barrier against storm surges and hurricanes like Katrina, because the sediments are not there to build up the coast. And it's not just a problem in the Gulf Coast of the U.S. It's a big issue here in Europe, where the Camargue, this very famous delta wild area in the south of France, is losing several meters a year because of the trapping of sediments upstream in the River Rhône. And go around the world, many cases, it's a very common problem. So this whole range of human rights and environmental impacts, and our rivers are this incredibly important resource and are just going to get more important as climate change takes hold. And it's going to be, if we want to be able to adapt to climate change, be resilient to climate change, we need to preserve our wild rivers and keep them as corridors for wildlife to be able to migrate. And if we continue damming them and destroying them, we're going to make ourselves even more vulnerable to the impacts of climate change.
I'm speaking with Patrick McCulley, Executive Director of International Rivers, based in Berkeley, California. We haven't really talked about the problems with cap and trade. A lot of environmentalists like the idea of capping emissions. Economists tend to prefer the idea of taxing carbon. So there's this kind of debate within the carbon reduction community. But what's your analysis of cap and trade? Is it a good idea? Can it work?
Again, it's incredibly complicated. There are different ways in which cap and trade can be implemented. There's the big distinction is the big issue in cap and trade is how do you distribute the allowances to pollute. So you set a cap, and then emitters, industries, coal producers, and so on, power plants will get allowances to be able to operate and to be able to emit. But should they be given out for free, which has numerous problems attached with it, and how many should be given out, or should they be sold off? And then the issue is how should they be sold off? Now, in Europe, where they installed several years ago a cap-and-trade system, it's turned out to be pretty much counterproductive so far in terms of it hasn't stopped the increase in emissions, because they handed out all the emission permits for free, and they handed out far too many of them, and this turned into a windfall profits for especially Europe's big, most polluting coal-burning utilities, especially in Germany, who made billions of dollars because although they were handed out the allowances for free, the allowances had a value. The utilities then passed on the cost of those, or the value of those allowances, onto their customers and made billions of dollars and didn't reduce their emissions. Now, going forward, Europe is talking about starting to auction emissions and rapidly increasing the number which are auctioned. And potentially, if you had a full auctioning system, you might not have actually a lot of trading, because companies would only buy the number of emission permits they thought they needed, and they would only trade. If they had bought too many, they would trade. If they didn't buy enough, they would buy from other people. But the impact under full auctioning may be something similar to a carbon tax, but it all depends on how the system is implemented, and these systems are incredibly complicated. lot of people say that tax is much more efficient and more simple to implement than carbon trading system. But the fans of cap and trade will say, well, with cap and trade, at least you can set a cap. You can say this is the maximum of emissions, and we won't allow any emissions beyond this. And with a tax, it's more difficult to do that because you don't really know at what rate of tax is necessary to bring emissions down by a certain amount. So I think there's good arguments for and against taxes and trading, but it's very clear that if you have a cap and giveaway system, you give away all these allowances, you've got a really problematic system that's likely to be very inefficient and basically just not work, as it hasn't worked so far in Europe.
Now, both our presidential candidates are pledged allegiance to some kind of cap and trade system. You said something about McCain's earlier. What's your evaluation of these?
Big glaring weakness, fatal weakness in McCain's system is that he says he would initially allow unlimited use of offsets. And what that means is that, say, U.S. emitters have to reduce their emissions by 10% over the first 10 years of the scheme. What they'll be able to do under the McCain scheme is keep their emissions the same or grow their emissions, but just buy these offsets from abroad. So you will see no reduction in emissions in the U.S., much fewer emissions overseas than are supposed to have happened because of this additionality problem. You will have none of the benefits that you will get from an emissions cap, a real emissions cap, in terms of forcing innovation, forcing the switch to clean fuels, which will have a big benefit beyond just climate change. For example, with coal, you burn less coal, you have less problems with mountaintop removal, you have less of the local pollutants like nitrogen oxides and sulfur dioxide, and you have this impact that you're promoting innovation in these new technologies, which are going to be the way of the future, which are going to eventually bring down our power costs, because as we have more investment going into clean technologies, they are going to drop in price. So we're not going to see all those benefits under the McCain plan if the U.S. polluters are just allowed to buy these offsets from overseas. Obama's plan is more nuanced. It's in some ways vaguer in that it says there will be an allowance for offsets, but it certainly will not be unlimited the way it is under McCain, but we don't know what level it will be. And even under the recently announced California plan to try and meet with its greenhouse gas emissions law, that it also allows for the use of offsets, but again doesn't specify how many. I think it will not be a large part of the emission reduction commitment, but just the fact it does allow for offsets will weaken the what can be achieved in California.
And finally, we're going to be seeing a negotiation for successor to the Kyoto Protocol beginning, I believe, next year. What would you like to see in that kind of arrangement? What have we learned from Kyoto that we don't want to repeat, and what's a better way to do it?
Well, we need to move forward pretty fast with much more substantial cuts than under Kyoto. I mean, everybody, even the strongest supporters of Kyoto, will agree that it was only just a first sort of faltering step, but now we've really got to get serious. The science is much firmer than it was before and much more alarming in terms of showing how rapid and deep the cuts need to be. So we need to come up with an agreement that really matches the science. So it means the industrialized countries taking on substantial commitments to cut their emissions. And it means the developing countries at least getting on the path where they start to bring down their rate of growth, and then over the longer term, they're also going to have to reduce their emissions. Now, the big sticking point in all this, always in these international negotiations, is sort of who pays and who jumps first. And clearly, the industrialized countries have to jump first. They've got to take on these commitments and start taking serious action. And they're going to have to transfer quite sizable amounts of money, not large amounts of money if you take into account sort of military budgets, or, but still relatively large amounts of money to pay for adaptation for climate change, measures such as better flood management and protection against droughts and so on, and the transfer of these sort of cheap or these clean technologies to developing countries and helping developing countries move away from dirty fuels to cleaner ones. And what's really important is that the mechanism that transfers the funds is not an offsets-based mechanism as we have now, because it's turning out to be a mess. It's promoting the wrong types of technologies. It's not transferring actually nearly enough money, and it's giving this fake impression that emissions are actually being reduced when, in fact, they're not.
Final word, can we do it or are we doomed?
I hope very much we can do it.
That was Patrick McCulley, Executive Director of International Rivers, based in Berkeley. International Rivers does great work. Longtime listeners might remember Patrick's evisceration of World Bank apologist Sebastian Malaby on his show back in 2004. Malaby made some outrageous claims about environmentalists in Uganda that turned out to be entirely untrue, but they won unchallenged in the big media. That's why we're here. If you want to check the show out, it's in my radio archive at leftbusinessobserver.com. Look for the October 14, 2004 show. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about temp work. Some more feelies, this from the last roundup. My next guest is Vicki Smith. Vicki Smith is chair of the sociology department at the University of California, Davis, and co-author, along with Esther Neuwirth, of The Good Temp, just out from Cornell University Press. Every workday, over 2 million Americans report for temp jobs. It's a giant business and also a major influence on how we see work in general these days. The book is an exploration of how we got here, how the industry works, the kinds of workers it expects and molds, and what's in it for employers, and how we can make the jobs a little better. Vicki Smith.
Welcome to Behind the News, Vicki Smith. The image of the temp has changed radically from the days of the Kelly girl. First, remind us of how it used to be.
Well, those days are long behind us now. After World War II, up to the early 1960s, temporary employment was a marginal labor practice. Mostly women worked temporary jobs, and the temp was a person who was brought in to cover for a permanent worker if that worker was sick or on vacation. And so the temp was truly a temporary worker. The field of temporary employment was dominated almost exclusively by women, and many of them married women. So I think the major thing is that it was mostly women working those jobs, and that it was a relatively marginal labor practice at that time.
And then that changed starting when?
Actually, as early as the mid-1960s, there a conversation, a kind of national conversation about the benefits of temporary employment started to filter into business magazines and personnel magazines, where people from the temporary help service industry as well as business leaders started talking about how companies could really benefit from using temporary workers on a much more widespread basis. We were very surprised to find that it was as early as the 60s that discussions about how temporary employment could be different for U.S. employers started to emerge. There were many discussions of why temporary employment could be better. Companies wanted flexibility. Their profits were squeezed increasingly. Employers were worried about having permanent labor forces that were too big and bulky. And temporary employment was offered up as a solution to that.
It's funny this started changing in the 60s because that's what we think of the era of the permanent job, the golden age of employment.
That's exactly right. And I think that's what's very interesting about it when you look at it historically. We think that
the whole temporary health service industry, and we're not the only people that think this. This has been thrown around for quite a while now. But this industry played a key role in starting to unravel the good permanent job. A lot of the discussions that were taking place about the benefits of temporary employment attacked permanent employment. They attacked the full-time cradle-to-grave kind of employment system where workers had security, where they worked full-time. And so it was in that period, the 60s and then on into the early 70s, there were a lot of contested ideas about what was a good kind of employment or a good model of employment. Of course, most of this is asking that question from the point of view of employers, not what's good for the workers.
There are two conflicting views of these temporary jobs. One, the kind of free agent nation view, someone is kind of bold and entrepreneurial and not stodgy, constantly reinventing himself or herself, and the disposable worker view, that these are ruthlessly exploited people who have no future. Where does the truth lie?
If you look at temporary employment, the field is divided into contract workers, who are a type of temporary worker. These contractors tend to be much more highly paid. They tend to be highly educated and have skills that are very marketable. They work with a different set of agencies, the higher level type of agency, you know, even some headhunter agencies. So people like that, those are the free agents. They make choices. They can pick and choose the kind of jobs that they want. And many of those people embrace this model of employment, the kind of job hopping and having a lot of movement, both organizational and geographic movement in their careers. But they're a small percentage of temporary workers, and the vast majority are these lower-level temps that we talk about in the good temp. These folks, of course, there's not a single bit of disagreement about the fact that these jobs are disadvantageous compared to other kinds of jobs. The wages are lower. They almost never have benefits. There's tremendous insecurity, uncertainty, because you really don't know how long your job is going to last. It's cruel to call people in this situation a free agent. They are much more constrained in the kinds of choices they can make. So there is some differentiation in this whole field, but the people that are most affected by this are people who aren't making a lot of money and who oftentimes today are trying to support families. I think that's another piece of the change that we've seen over the last 40 years. Now, when you look at the population of people who work as temporary workers, you're as likely to be a man as a woman. And you're as likely to be an adult as a college student. And so this is a population that's very dependent on a very insecure and low-paid type of employment.
According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers, about 2% of all jobs are with temp firms, and about 5% of all employment is contingent by some broader definition. Yet the perception is widespread that the entire job market is like that. We're all temp workers now. Where does this perception come from?
You probably know there's a ongoing debate about how insecure jobs have really become. And when we look at that figure of 2%, which actually I've seen estimates of 2 to 4%, you know, if we want to look at the largest estimates of contingent temporary workers, it's small and it sounds small, and people might be tempted to say, well, you know, what's the big deal? This isn't a really widespread practice. We think that the problem is that even though at any particular time of the year a relatively small percentage of people are affected, it's a growing kind of culture or a set of beliefs that employment in general has become a lot more contingent. And I tend to think of the culture of employment as being very different today than it was 40 or 50 years ago. Very few people feel that they have a so-called permanent job. If you work for an employer who hires temps, and you're a so-called permanent worker, you might look at those temps and say, this might happen to me. People, of course, the larger context is that companies lay off employees a lot. We've been seeing a lot of news about that just in the last couple of days. Everybody has a pretty high level of insecurity about their job. So we think that the temporary employment system is kind of a template It shows what's possible, you know, what more and more employees might experience. Another part of the insecurity there is the issue about health benefits, that people fear having jobs that aren't going to provide benefits, which is a main characteristic of these low-level temporary jobs.
How do most firms treat their temp workers? You gave one example of IKEA, where the temp workers wore T-shirts to say, don't ask me any hard questions, but I imagine that's the extreme. How integrated or how separated are temp employees made to feel?
We have found different examples. Employers tend to approach this in different ways. Many companies do have strict policies whereby they segregate their temporary workers from other workers. The basic issue is that they don't want their temps to have any confusion at all about the fact that they're not employees of the firm where they're working. So temps might work off in a separate area. They might wear different colored smocks, you know, from the regular employees. They might have a tag that really blares out the fact that they're a temporary worker. We found examples where companies would have social events for their regular employees, and temps were not invited to those social events. At the same time, there are examples of where temps are integrated into work processes, where employers need them to just get in there side by side with other workers, and they're doing the same kind of work that regular workers do. And in some cases, temps get appointed as the lead workers of groups. So it's a very mixed kind of situation. In general, I think employers are pretty conscious about the fact that they're not supposed to make their temps feel that they might really be a member of that community, that they're really an employee of that company. There can't be any ambiguity about it, because that's when temporary workers will say, look, you know, you've treated me just the same way. I've done just the same thing as your other workers, and yet you pay me less, you don't allow me to participate in your stock option plan and things like that. So it's a very tricky area.
I'm speaking with Vicki Smith, co-author of The Good Temp. Temp firms are kind of funny. They've got almost two sets of customers, one the workers that they have to attract and retain and filter, and the companies that they provide those workers to. Are these competing roles, synergistic roles? How do they balance out those forces?
Temporary agencies, and here we really talk about your kind of mainstream temporary agency that you would be likely to find in the yellow pages. That, in other words, it's not a fly-by-night kind of operation or anything like that. Agencies do have to balance these competing demands and constituencies in a way. They have to sell their services to people who are looking for temporary jobs. We looked at the way that an agency really tried to offer various services to its temps in order to create a workforce of good temporary workers. And that's kind of an irony in itself. We often think of temps as uninterested, non-committed, people who don't really care about the quality of their work, because why should they? They're just a temp. That they may go in and not be very productive and things like that. In fact, agencies have a strong investment in developing a core of workers who will be willing to go in and work on a temporary basis, who will be attached to the particular places that they work, even if it's for a short-term basis, who are going to be reliable, who can even take initiative. It's very interesting. We don't expect these things of a temporary worker. But temporary employment has become so normalized that employers can't ignore temps in that way. They have to hope that these are going to be good workers for their purposes. So agencies often will train temporary workers in basic skill sets. Maybe it's learning new software packages or learning how to work with computer boards. They will train temps how to conduct an effective interview. Not everybody knows how to do well in an interview. They'll help them beef up their resumes and talk to them about the culture of different firms. At the same time, agencies have to make sure that these temps are going and are going to have reasonable work conditions, because if temps get sent off to crummy jobs, they're not going to return to that particular agency. So we found a lot of evidence where the people who ran the agency would go into companies who were going to hire temps, and they would work with managers there to improve the wages for temps. They would make sure that the jobs were reasonably safe, not high risk. They worked to kind of tone down abusive management behavior because it was very counterproductive and temps would just walk off the job. So it is this kind of ongoing balancing act that the staff of the agency have to deal with.
We're about 13 minutes into the interview, and I'm finally getting around to asking you, what's a good temp?
Ah, yes, a good temp. It's a product. The temporary help service industry has worked to develop this product over decades. They've marketed this product in much the same way other companies market their commodities, the way Starbucks creates a whole set of coffee drinks, or Apple develops the Air and other fancy products that everybody wants to buy today. The good temp is an idea, and oftentimes temporary workers are good temporary workers, not always, but it's the idea that the temporary workforce can be a reliable, committed workforce, that there's something that's a great advantage to the temporary worker if employers use them. And so we kind of look at the way this idea of something called the good temp evolved over the last few decades. It's not just temporary workers. It's not just this generic thing that, you know, agencies send out into firms. It's workers who have very specific characteristics, the willingness to work as a temporary worker. Not everybody is going to be willing to do that. The ability to have, you know, the basic work skills people need, be show up on time, be cooperative with other workers, maybe even have certain social relational skills. And so it's, in general, it refers to the emergence of a new type of worker. The good worker of the mid-20th century was probably the white male industrial worker who had a career, worked all of his life, worked full-time. That model now is ridiculed often, thought of as complacent and non-productive. The good temporary worker is a person who embraces flexibility and desires change, new challenging situations, and will go in and be minimally enthusiastic about doing the job. Again, we don't try to say that all temps are like this, but we think that it's an image, and an image of a product that the industry has tried to create since around the 1960s.
Much of what you say would apply to what employers in general want from workers. They want them to be cheerful, cooperative, show up on time, not steal stuff, get along with their fellow workers, smile at the customers. They don't necessarily want them to solve differential equations. So is there something that distinguishes what employers want from the good temp rather than the good non-temp?
Well, we think so, because for a long time when people were studying temporary workers, there was kind of this unstated assumption that temporary workers were just not really very good workers, that you could never rely on them. They weren't going to be dependable. They weren't going to care about quality. They weren't going to identify with the company. There was a very mechanical view of temps. You just throw them out there, you know, the hiring company brings them in when they need them, and then when they don't need them, they get rid of them. That is the basic image of the disposable temp. In fact, many temporary workers don't work like that. They're not a mechanical factor of production. They're people who care about their jobs. They're people who would like permanent jobs, and often that's a reason that they're working as a temp, is to hopefully bridge into a company for full-time permanent employment. And so that view of the temp, I think, is very different.
There's certainly some advantages for workers who want something out of temporary work. You mentioned something called transitional mobility. What's that?
There have been a number of studies in the last several years that have showed us that, in fact, taking jobs as temporary workers can be very advantageous for groups of people who have had trouble accessing the labor market. And what I mean by that is people who don't have connections, people who don't have networks, people who may lack much in the way of education and may lack skills as well. It's fairly easy for people to go into a temporary agency and get placed by that agency. Temporary agencies are willing to work with people to help them kind of bring their basic skills up to par. when people then go on to work as a temp in a company, it gives them a chance to prove themselves. It's almost a probationary period. And there's been a lot of research on the fact that that's one of the main functions of the temporary employment system today. Employers don't want to hire people right off the street as permanent workers to an increasing degree. They want to watch people. They want to make sure that this is going to be the right person to hire. And so this arrangement is kind of a bridge opportunity for folks who have been left out of these opportunity systems. They can go in, they can get the experience, they can, you know, more or less prove themselves on the job, and very often will be hired into a permanent job. If you look at the American staffing industry figures, they say that about 6 of 10 people go into temporary employment today in the hopes of finding a permanent job. In the current situation of a fairly high underemployment rate, this is one of the ways that people are really struggling to move into a situation of full employment for themselves.
Still, for whatever virtues they have, these are mostly low-paying, no-benefit, insecure jobs. Is there any way to make them better for the workers?
Well, yep, that's a big question. We think that there are things that can be done to improve the general situation of temporary workers, that if agencies are encouraged to use a set of best practices, that is to really work with the interest of workers in mind, helping them to improve their skills, helping them gain access to even low-level jobs in so-called good companies, that could be very helpful. I think that one thing to hope for is that if a worker is working in a low-level job as a temp, if they can segue into a permanent job, it might still be low-level and the wages may not be high, but at least they've got their foot in the door and then they may be able to move up, even if to a limited degree inside the company. It's a thorny issue to whether the jobs themselves can be really improved.
I think she meant no, but maybe it's just too harsh to say that. Unionizing Kelly Services seems even harder than organizing Walmart. That was Vicki Smith, co-author, along with Esther Newworth, of The Good Temp, just out from Cornell University Press. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with some more feelies, this from their cover of the Velvet Underground's What Goes On. Till next week, bye.